Hey everybody, welcome to Public Access America's
Just the Tip.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Public Access America. My name is Jason, but there is many people that are a part of this podcast. We're about to sit down with Jeffrey, my partner, and Marco from the Audio Pong podcast. So my first tip, I guess, would be go ahead and seek out the Audio Pong podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Player FM, anywhere you find your favorite podcast, the same way you would find Public Access America. But my real tip, I think, is take the opportunities to interact with the people that you get a chance to interact with, right? We don't always get the chance to learn the lessons we want to learn, but we do have the opportunity to take advantage of the lessons that we're taught. Maybe not being the smartest person in the room gives us an opportunity to hear something that we wouldn't normally allow ourselves to hear. That's what this podcast is going to be, so thank you for listening.
It's time now for something positive.
We might be headed to the promised land.
Our external liberty once we internally liberate ourselves.
The problem can only be solved when there is a kind of coalition of conscience.
This is the beginning, it is not the finale, and that's why we're here, and that's why we rally.
We've got to be that creative minority.
Find a way to get in the way. I got in trouble, it was good trouble, it was necessary trouble.
Franklin, I know we've got to do something.
Is everything clear on my end? Am I coming through clearly? No echoing or anything?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you sound
clear. You're good.
Okay.
And that's the first thing that actually, like, connected. Well, actually, we connected on Red Circle. And
we did.
We did a cross-promotion. And our cross-promotion literally lasted, like, 3 days before it was completed. And that was, like, 500. Like, we switched off. We put 500 of your commercial in our shows. And it was over in, like, 3 days. And I still have podcasts that are, like, playing my promo because they don't get the listens that you and I do. But then I listen.
Oh, well, that's good to know. Yeah. And it's a good way to look at it.
You guys have these like voices that are like butter. And I really like Audio Pong. And so, hey, everybody, welcome to Public Access America. My name is Jason. His name is still Jeffrey. We're here with Marco from Audio Pong, and we get together once a week to talk about the week. You can find Audio Pong or Public Access America anywhere you find your favorite podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. I found Audio Pong on Twitter, so go find them there. And for our disabled listeners, try Victor Reader or use your Audible, your smart device, and ask it to play the latest episode of either show. And I don't know, you might want to switch to Audio Pong this week because the topics might get a little heavy, because this has been a real week, guys, you know. But I want to start out by turning people onto Audio Pong in case this gets too heavy. They know where to go. So Marco, what is Audio Pong all about?
Hi, thanks Jason and Jeffrey for having me on. Audio Pong is an art project, you could say. It started as two guys that just had really great conversations and touched on a lot of topics. And sometimes we'd speak for hours, sober even, which was surprising. And we thought, well, you know, let's just add a microphone to this and see where it goes. And it turned into something that we just really love to do. We used to do it weekly. Now we do it sort of bi-weekly. That way it gives us more of a chance to research a topic. I think we're more into, at least recently, we've been more into like book studies, like book reviews, things like that.
Right.
Trying to be able to talk more about a topic that interests us. But that's really all that it is at the moment, at least. It's a foundation for us to do more with and to talk with people, even if it's just ourselves. I feel what's great about radio or podcasting in general is that it's a conversation sort of existentially between people around the world.
That's right. And I always think if we can, it's like a dinner table. If people are listening to you, then they're learning how to have conversations without being angry and fighting with each other, because they hear people just talking. And like, well, I think what you guys do is you offer a little gift, or several gifts in the show, but then you open it up and you don't really have to define it to describe it. And I think that's really cool, the way you attack things like, is love real? You know, that just stopped me in my tracks. I was like, I never even really thought of that. You know what I mean? So I like the topics you cover. I like the way you non-judgmentally address them. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much.
Definitely. Is there anything on your mind this week? And did this week just conjure up anything?
Well, you know, I was listening to one of your episodes. I think it was your last one, actually. Jeffrey had mentioned Parthenax, and I just wanted to say I love that quote as well.
Nice.
But that's a week out. I should have my own, I guess. words of wisdom. Something that's always on my mind is mental health. And there's a really interesting psychologist named Guy Winch. I'm not exactly sure which part of the world he's from, but it's somewhere in Europe. You should definitely give a listen to him. And the point that he makes is that we never prioritize our mental health. You know, if we get a scrape, we put a bandage on it. If we break a leg, we see a doctor to fix it. But when it comes to something mentally, we leave it alone, or worse, we attack it, right? Where we become our own enemy.
Right.
And it could be something minute, you know, like how you close that drawer, slam that door. And I guess my top of mind is stress. It relates in the way that everything that we do in life, and I've mentioned this, I don't know how many times, but everything we do is a management of stress, right? Even to the most minute detail or event. And so that's always on my mind. I guess that I'll go with that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I distract myself from stress. How about you, Jeffrey?
Oh, well, I mean, it just kind of depends for me. It depends on where I'm at. I actually like to bake when I'm stressed. Mm. It's not necessarily one of the, it's not necessarily, you know, one of the, you know, maybe healthiest choices, but it's kind of that, you know, it kind of goes back to that, you know, what can I smell? What can I taste? What can I touch? What can I hear? You know, what, you know, just kind of grounding myself is what I'm doing.
Right.
And I never understood that for a lot of years. When I would get super stressed out, I would turn on music and I would start baking. It turns out it's a grounding technique. I didn't have the words for it because I didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
But as I've come to learn, I'm grounding myself. Like you know, getting out of my own head for a minute and, you know, using, you know, because baking is very much a science, and using that to, you know, make something, smell something, taste something, hear something, feel something, and then come back to whatever it is that has me stressed out. On the downside, because I actually do just enjoy baking, sometimes I'll just be like, you know, I'm gonna make some cookies today. This just sounds great. Debbie walks in, it's like, you okay, buddy?
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, yeah, no, I'm actually fine. I'm actually perfectly fine. I just wanted to make cookies.
cooking in general is surprisingly entertaining, and the problem solving, that's something that I love, is to problem solve, and cooking and baking, definitely. I would agree with that. That's a good way to sort of exercise your mental ability even.
Yeah. And you do something with your hands when you're in the kitchen that doesn't allow you to be on your phone or the tablet, you know?
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yep. So
the disconnection from technology is, I guess, also a top of mind.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I've been slowly doing that. I mean, being a podcaster and having to promote like the show is one thing, but I've limited where I do that in my exposure to other things and things that I don't approve of.
We struggle with that,
you know?
Yeah. Now, we struggle with that quite a bit because Zach and I are both of a similar mind when it comes to using social media. We don't like it. We don't like doing it. So we're really bad used car salesmen about our own content.
Right.
And you made a good point. Actually, I was surprised rather that you mentioned you found us on Twitter. That blows my mind. That is next to YouTube, the thing we use the least and, you know, something I should improve on.
Well, actually, I research politicians, I have scientists, and so the first thing I do when I hear a name is go to Twitter, type it in, and because that offers me a link. Like every politician has a link to their office and phone number. It's required on every public profile they have. So I've just learned how to research people, and yeah, that was amazing. So I tweeted you out as a podcast recommendation, and I like that.
Oh, thank you very much for doing that.
Yeah, no, I like having a group of people that just communicate and then just like swapping perspectives and seeing where that goes. You know, like you said, last week we had Deja, who was a Latino transgender Democrat in Philadelphia, you know? And it was like, let's bring that perspective in and see where the conversation goes, you know?
That was a very interesting, yeah, that was a very interesting show to listen to. And I agree, that's actually where I want to take our show next, is to do more of what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
Even if it's, you know, repeated, I think it's great. It's very interesting to me.
Oh, I think we repeat mental health every week, don't we, Jeffrey?
If it doesn't come up every week, I'm honestly surprised. But you know, you think about it, you know, where else do you hear the topic of mental health? And it's a real question for me, because mm-hmm. you don't really talk about it at work unless something comes up. You don't really talk, you know, maybe you talk about it at home. I had to have some very tough conversations around mental health at home this week, you know, with one of my kids. And that's, you know, Marco, kind of what you said, you know, we've kind of gotten to the point, at least in this house, where, you know, if you need a mental Band-Aid, you know, we've really embraced the idea of taking mental health days,
right?
You know, because there are some things that come up that just absolutely drain you. They're absolutely difficult. And to not take some time away to either process or, you know, come down from whatever you've had to experience. Like if you don't take that time, you know, it comes back, it bottles you, you bottle it up, and, you know, you don't deal with it all that well. And so really it's, I don't really know where else you necessarily have such an open forum about mental health, unless you're going to see, you know, somebody who specializes in mental health.
Well, that's a good point. And I think about that too. I've mentioned before, psychologist and author Daniel Kahneman, and he talks about that too, that these quietly, this is not verbatim, but he refers to these sort of quiet taboos that we just don't bring up in any philosophical way between strangers and coworkers or even, you know, acquaintances, because we're sort of always in a persona that is the idea that, well, we're in a persona that is a commercial for our most likable self,
right?
And serious or negative or philosophical things often conjure a lot of negative thoughts. They require us to be rational or logical, that sort of thing, maybe critical, or even argue and debate, which I actually believe that many people, in my opinion, that I've met and spoken to, aren't ready to properly debate. That's something that I study all the time myself. I think it should be a class even in public school. I think debating is very important, how to speak to each other.
Agreed.
Makes a big difference.
I mean, civics used to be, you know, taught in schools, you know, back in the day. It was one of those things where we always, you know, my mom always talked about the fact that, you know, they took government classes, they took any number of different things in order to get, you know, to kind of inform themselves, but, you know, in order to go out in public. And these are things that have not really happened in a long time. And so it's really pretty surprising that we don't talk about that at all.
Yeah, I would even say it's rather disconcerting. It's disheartening, because I think civics and art, and when I say art, I mean music, writing, drawing, all of that.
Spontaneous thoughts.
Yeah, they're necessary for imagination, and imagination is how you solve any problem.
Oh my God, you were talking about that. I do want to say, like, I think what Jeffrey was talking about, I think we create a schedule for our day, but we don't leave time for spontaneous things that fall into our lap. So we immediately become overwhelmed because we don't just lay around. And I like taking a day at the end of the week to think about the week, to prioritize what I'm going to do going forward. I like having that mental day. And what you were describing is almost like what we portray in public is an avatar of ourselves, and we don't spend a lot of time on the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, but we sculpt our avatars to be what we think people want, and that causes a disconnect and a lot of stress.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, we're creatures of first impressions,
right?
Without a doubt.
Mm-hmm. And well, it's also, I would also say that, you know, when we find coworkers that we get along with really well, it's not because they've, you know, they think our sales pitch self is all that great. It's because they've actually gotten to know the real us. We've gotten to know the real them, and we just happen to click really well. Right. I mean, that's case in point with my coworkers. It's like, they see who I am, the jokes I make, the, you know, granted, I wouldn't say I don't give them my authentic self. I just don't give them my, my salty language self. I still keep things somewhat professional in the workplace, you know, but I don't, you know, but I'm not like giving them my dirty jokes and crap like that, you know, just because like time and place.
Right.
Let other
people define the parameters in the situation, mm-hmm. and then don't go past those, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it's sort of a wall of filter to let the right ones in, I suppose.
Right.
Absolutely. But no, to your point, Marco, we do spend a lot of time, like, you know, if we're not at elevator pitch, we're at, you know, I would, you know, use car salesman, you know, we're trying to impress whoever it is that we're trying to get a raise from, who we're trying to, you know, get promoted from, you know, we spend a lot of time with that rather than, you know, just saying, hey, look, you know, I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. You clearly trust me with what I'm doing. I can make that happen.
I do want to say, I forgot to mention at the top of the show, there's people that lost their mothers in this pandemic, and today takes on a new special meaning for those people that did lose those parental figures or mothers or, you know, patriarchal influencers. And I just want to say happy Mother's Day to all of you.
Indeed, happy Mother's Day.
I wanted to start the show with that. I spend all week, every day I wake up, and I think this is a social media driven thing, and I try, and I always think, how am I going to start the show this week? And this week I heard a phrase at the beginning of the week, and I was like, I love it, and I wanted to offer it to everybody as a mental health objective. And the word is cuddle puddle. Cuddle puddle is just a puddle of cuddle. And I love the idea of that. All I did was think of rainbows and happiness. So if you're going to take a mental health day with your family, maybe put on like a bad movie and just get into a cuddle puddle, you know? And then of course it was abortion and Judge Alito. And I was like, oh, I don't want to start the show with that. And then it was Amber and Johnny. And I was like, Amber, Johnny, and then it was abortion again. But then it was Mother's Day. And so I love hearing what was top of mind. I appreciate you taking it in that direction, Marco. We promote somebody called the EarKick app, which is a way to document your good and bad days and then see them over time. They have like an audio ambient mixer where you can add music that calms you down and listen to that. And it's just a great app. So go check out the EarKick app, everybody, for better mental health, because documenting it is part of recognizing it. You said something about trying to fight our mental health, like the things that, you know, we have to fight to get our mental health. And like depression is one of those things. And so what I always say is like, feel your depression, lean into it. Like the first day or two, don't live in it, lean into it. And then you'll find out your analytical mind wants to know what that's about. You know what I mean? And then once you start analyzing it, it just becomes blasé and no more fun. And you just don't do it.
Well, John Cleese had a really interesting lecture. I think it was back in the 70s or early 80s on creativity. And a point that he made, which I think was the strongest takeaway, was that you need to assign time for yourself where you are just creative.
Yeah.
You know, you're just alone and you're creative. And the busier your mind is, the more time it's going to take. So for someone like him, he argued that, you know, in half an hour was not enough. He couldn't even quiet his mind down in half an hour. It took, you know, at least an hour. And I can relate to that. I don't have the samurai brain that a musician has, like my brother, who can just pick up a guitar and instantly the world is blinded from his thought. I'm easily distracted. The way you put it, you know, it's Mother's Day, it's abortion, there's Amber and Johnny, and you know, and it's just, there's things constantly, you know, flooding in, so to speak.
Yeah. Those things that we didn't plan for.
Right. Yeah.
And I thought it was,
I leave the gas on.
I thought it was interesting. I was looking up, I was watching Ancient Aliens, and they were talking about how Albert Einstein went about his thought process, and he used to do thought experiments. So I looked up thought experiments, and I was listening to your show, and you were explaining how you have a hard time meditating or quieting your mind, right? And how it's hard, right. It's hard to do that. And I had that problem too. And then I looked into the thought experiment, and once you can get those going, they're pretty neat. What he imagined was he was riding a light particle through the universe and what the universe would look like during that. And the more we do that, the more we strip away the preconceived definitions of, you know, the borders, and we start to imagine things the way they could possibly be. And so I just had a real fun time, like, looking up thought experiments and different ways to quiet the mind, but yet still think and engage my mind as well, because my mind is going to repeat, and it's like a slot machine. It's constantly different thoughts. And so,
we love rewatching content.
Right.
So, and that goes with our own thoughts.
I have to think, but then throttle down and think and throttle down and think. Like you said, it can't happen in just an hour, you know?
Well, my favorite thought experiment is The Pale Blue Dot by Carl Sagan.
Tell me more.
Which I think was from his first episode of, I forget the name of the show now. They just redid it with Neil deGrasse Tyson not long ago. Mm-hmm. But he touches him.
Cosmos.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Yeah. Which is something I highly recommend everybody watch, at least the original for sure.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a very similar thought experiment. You know, as you pull away from the earth, the trivialities that we deal with on a daily basis, you know, even if they're just a thought experiment themselves, it's so meaningless.
Right.
Not as to say that life itself is meaningless, because I don't think it is. I think it's precious, but to the universe, you know, the universe doesn't care what we're arguing about.
Yeah.
No, I think one of my favorite thought experiments that I absolutely love. And these are some of my favorites to kind of understand how people think. The first one is, you know, what do you think humanity would look like if, you know, aliens actually arrived on this planet and they wanted to meet us, not go to war with us, just we actually have definitive proof, it's here in your face, there is no getting away from it, that aliens, you know, come to visit us. You know, what does humanity look like that the moment after intelligent life from another planet exists and we have to confront that? Do all the things that we've thought about suddenly become meaningless? Do they become more meaningful? Do we experience a new love for humanity? Do we experience a new hatred for something different? It's always interesting for me to see how some people just cannot comprehend the idea that there is any other kind of life form out there besides us. And how some, you know, would be like, I honestly, you know, I don't know what I would do, but I would love to find out.
You can imagine.
Well, it's also too. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's it. That's all I had to say. You can imagine it, though.
Well, it's fun to imagine, too. And I think I've had that conversation in different ways with other people. Mm-hmm. And it seems that it's almost always instantly a religious conversation. Mm-hmm. I forget who asked the question. It might have been Daniel Dennett, but he said, "What if God did visit us? Mm-hmm. You know, how do we recognize God if He did visit us?" And I actually asked that question once because I have a very religious family. They're mainly Christian. And one question I asked a family member once was, "You know, if a man walked up to you in your street, he looked like Jesus. He looked like him. He spoke the way you thought he would speak." He dressed the way you thought he would dress, and he performed a very simple miracle in his hand. He turned an origami frog into a frog. Would you believe him that he was Jesus? And she said, no. And I thought it was very interesting because it seemed convincing to me, but sure. She said, no. I said, well, why not? She said, well, you know, there's people can pull all kinds of tricks. There are ways to get around that. So it brought up the idea in my mind. Well, then why do we convince ourselves? Where are our perceptions solid and fluid as far as that is concerned? I think that would be interesting, of course, to be visited by intelligent life, but yeah. I think any life found in the universe outside our planet would be profound.
Oh, absolutely.
If people can pull tricks, though, couldn't the original Jesus have been pulling tricks?
That's always the fun question. And I think that we could go down that list of, you know, the blind man that could see, you know, wasn't that just one of Jesus's friends? Or, you know, the fig tree that died when Jesus damned it, you know, is that just hyperbole, or was that a tree that was already dying? You know, you can try and answer, explain away all of it. And I think you'll get to know a person in a way that it, you know, it's funny, because you'll see how they'll explain away something that they wholeheartedly believe that's written in the Bible, or vice versa. They'll explain something away, but then, you know, or they'll explain themselves into essentially, you know, believing the Bible. And it's a really interesting concept to watch how people struggle with that back and forth. Yeah. My second favorite thought experiment is, kind of playing off of the first, if intelligent life shows up with a spaceship and they invite you to another planet, another solar system, another galaxy, to watch, you know, to live there and experience a sunrise and a sunset, knowing that you would have to leave your family behind, or, you know, you could take very few people with you, would you leave this planet? My answer is yes.
Yeah. I would know. And I asked myself the same question from watching that movie. What is it? The Spielberg movie, Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh, Close Encounters. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Close Encounters. Yeah.
Yep.
We're going to leave this earth and leave our family behind anyway, regardless. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It seems like a terrible thought, but really it's too exciting to turn down, right?
It's just jumping off the end of the pier before you get to the end of the pier. That's all that is.
You know, and it's funny, because you get a variety of answers. You have people who are like, I couldn't just leave all of my family. Mm-hmm. You get people who are like, well, if I could take, you know, some of my family with me, you know, I'd think about it, but there's so many things I haven't seen here. You know, like, yeah, there's a lot that I haven't seen here. I mean, but at the same time, if you told me that I would get to, you know, experience life on a different planet, and all I had to do was step on board.
Sure.
It's like, at what point does, you know, what we have here become meaningless?
I mean, Ezekiel took that ride, didn't he? In the Bible.
You'll have to remind me. It's been a while since I read the Bible.
Oh, God came down in a fiery storm and took Ezekiel up to the heavens, and Ezekiel pretty much described a spaceship, you know? And then Enoch, I think it is. Right? Like, there's two. I watch Ancient Aliens a lot, you know? I
love to reference that stuff.
I don't agree that, you know, everything that they're talking about is true, but looking at the megalithic structures to me is just amazing. And then little evidences that history is wrong, like finding human footprints next to dinosaur prints is amazing to me, because we think, well, we're about 5,000, 7,000 years old. And the dinosaurs, they went extinct 65 million years ago. So in that meantime, how did that happen? And I love that. You know what I mean? I don't care. I don't care about other life. It's going to affect me or not. But the history of our planet being expanded, that just amazes me, you know?
Well, it makes me think of, again, I've had the thought of like, well, what would an ancient troll be like?
Right.
What would he do? Right.
Yeah.
He can't go to YouTube to stir the pot. So maybe he made giant Big Bird feet and just walked around on a beach.
That's, you know, for
10 years straight.
Yeah.
Right. I love the idea that, you know, cause I mean, let's be real honest, practical jokers like us have been around for a long time.
Yeah.
So it's just always interesting to see how what that might have looked like. I mean, even to the point where it's like our very concept of, you know, animal intelligence has changed over the course of the course of, you know, modern history.
I agree. I used to work at medieval times, and I spent a lot of time working with the horses and training them, and that really I've always respected animal intelligence in the sense that I've never believed that they're just wholly stupid and that that they are so far removed from our own, let's say, level of thinking that right. we can disregard them. And I can tell you without any doubt that after working with horses, they have as much nuance to their personality and their intelligence, respective to themselves, as we do.
Yeah.
And I don't think that, I think that matters. I think, you know, I think that has a, that at least should be respected, but it by far more should be studied.
Oh, absolutely.
That I mean, was the question on Audio Pong, actually. What's the difference between us and humans, right?
Yeah, I do that to Zach all the time. And it's tough not to bring it, especially when we have a conversation like this. It's tough not to conjure that first. But
my, you know, it's for me, like the, I think the realization that I had, you know, was watching one of my dogs dream as a kid one time, you know, and even now when Billy's asleep and I'm watching her dream, it's like, If they were just, you know, mindless beings, you wouldn't see that. But they're dreaming.
Right.
What are they dreaming about? And you can tell that they have good dreams and they have bad dreams. You know, because I've seen, you know, Billy, you know, yipe in her sleep. I've watched Billy wag her tail in her sleep and you know, just, you know, there has to be a certain level of intelligence in order to have those kind of dreams.
Without a doubt. And I mean, in my opinion, I've read something about dreams. It's a very interesting topic to consider because the science behind it is, of course, neurological, but why does a mind of any level of intelligence generate abstract reality? The best theory idea I've heard about it is that the mind does not categorize fear or emergency to any sort of specific relevance. In other words, if you're in a fire that's burning down, or I'm sorry, if you're in a building that's burning down, as opposed to, I don't know, watching something else equally as tragic occur, the mind doesn't say, well, we're going to have one level of fear for that and another level of fear for the other instance, the other event. It's just the same level of fear occurring in your mind, the same emergency, the same level of adrenaline being pumped into you.
Ukraine do that. Cured COVID, right? Because they weren't fearing COVID anymore.
Yeah, right. There's not, you know, if you feared the pandemic as much as you fear war, in your mind, chemically, what's going on, it's equal, right? Even though you may think one is more drastic than the other. So dreams do that, though. Their abstractions generate fear and alarms, let's call them, that, according to this one psychologist, prepare us for similar levels of fear and emergency in real situations. And that made sense to me because it applied to me.
Wow. Okay.
My nightmares, you could say, helped me manage very stressful moments in my life, both in work and my personal life. And in a weird, abstract way, I was able to reference those nightmares. My mind brought me to that place so that I could calm myself down and approach things logically.
Can I tell you my last nightmare? I just had it last night.
Sure.
It was Flo from that insurance commercial laying in my bed in an apron, explaining to me why she wears an apron. And I woke up before she answered it. It was weird.
So now you're prepared for any boring board meeting you may have to go to about aprons.
But, you know, here's what's so interesting. I try and get stuff together for the minds that I have on, right? And of course, one of the questions I had was, are animals, what are the difference, right? And the second one was, are animals evolving on their own timeline? You know, like, why aren't elephants building houses, right? Because they're evolving on their own. We talked about animals. What if God was one of us is a question I had. We answered that. Is there life after death? We covered that. So I love the fact that I had us. I predicted a tangent, actually. I kind of like this.
Life after death. Yeah. So, I mean, you talk forever about any of those topics, right. I think.
Well,
when you say life after death, do you mean like conscious life after death?
Oh, probably not. Jeffrey was explaining how if he could go to space, he would. Mm-hmm. And all I was saying was that we're going to die and go there anyway, right? So
right.
Either we take the jump or we're going to be forced to go anyway. I don't know, energy doesn't dissipate, right? Einstein's.
Well, yeah, no, matter is never born, it's just reused. Right. So.
And I love universe analogies, you know? People always get upset when somebody disappears out of their life, but I always see it as like an orbit, right? Like you're the god Mars and you're on the other side of the sun as me right now, but you'll come back around, right? And so
that's a wonderful way to look at it.
I do have an interesting question. Let's get into this. I wrote down some questions for some of the most introspective and thoughtful minds that I was going to be around. So, and here's a real easy one to get us started. And this one is I came up with all on my own. Nobody has ever asked this question before. I find it fascinating. The chicken or the egg?
That is actually a really good question.
Well, I know the answer. I'm just wondering if you all do. You know what I mean?
The egg.
Yep. Okay. Good. Let's move on. I knew if they got boring, we would figure it out. I mean, well, what I think is that something resembling a chicken laid an egg that turned out to be more like a chicken that laid an egg that was finally a chicken that laid an egg. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That's essentially what Richard Dawkins talks about.
Fuck, I love this Richard Dawkins.
I think it was, I'm trying to remember the name of the book. The Selfish Gene. It's regarded, I think, as a scientific book, but really that book is something everyone should read. It really changed the way I even look at life in general, and it's just its origins and how it moves.
Mm-hmm. I love it. And I'll put the link in the description portion of this podcast so everybody can find that. Is it ethical to eat meat? I'm sorry.
Well, ethics, I mean, okay, if we try to apply, here's what I think. Morality is a fun thing to try and apply to everything, mm-hmm. because I think I agree with Christopher Hitchens that the origin of morality is selfish, but that doesn't make it disingenuous or evil. If we do good things, it makes it better for ourselves and others, right? So mm-hmm. generally it's born from survival. That's the way I look at it. But I don't think that the same level of ethics is applicable across the board. So, you know, there isn't like a morality hammer that we just smash everything with,
right?
You know, whether it's a glass egg or a skyscraper. So yes, I would say it is ethical to eat meat.
Me too.
I would agree with that.
Okay. As long as it's not a human meat.
You would be surprised how many people believe in consensual cannibalism.
That's a term. I haven't heard that one yet.
I
mean, thank you.
I used to bite my fingernails, right? So,
yeah. I mean, when you look at, you know, I mean, that's the thing is that when you look at ethics, it's you hear the argument animals don't want to be eaten. Well, you know, most people don't want to die either. But the thing about it is that when you look at consumption of meat, I would say that there is an ethical way to consume meat and there's unethical ways in which it's done. And I would argue that we constantly fight the unethical side of it, which is, you know, the mistreatment of the animals. You know, yes, even though it's destined to be on your dinner plate, that doesn't mean that you have the right to treat it with cruelty. You know, it's no different than when you're out hunting in the wild. You know, there's a certain level of respect you're supposed to have. And at some point, if you find yourself crossing that, you know, like killing an animal just for the sake of killing an animal, then you need to reevaluate yourself and your priorities.
Ooh, boom. Okay. Is it ever right to be wrong, Jeffrey? Is it ever okay to be wrong?
Oh, it's always okay to be wrong. It's just not okay to continue to be wrong when you've been educated on something.
How do you feel, Zach? Is it okay to be wrong once in a while?
Yeah, it's important to be wrong.
I like that.
I think going off what Jeffrey said, that you're malicious if you continually apply what is wrong, if it is harmful to others. In my mind, you know, not to be totally like callous, but I really don't care what people do as long as it doesn't harm others. If you're not harming anyone else with what you do, then it's okay to be so-called wrong. But if you're asking from a more of like scientific point of view, as you know, whether
any point of view,
sky is blue, for example, then yeah, or the earth is round, it's okay to be wrong as long as you're not harming others with your wrongness.
Right. Mm-hmm. I do this podcast to bring brighter minds in and diverse perspectives in to be proven wrong. Because if I'm proven wrong here, all those people that are listening that are also wrong, they don't have to be proved wrong to be enlightened. And so that's my whole thing. Agree. I love being wrong. Mm-hmm. I have no problem being wrong. And when people tell me I'm wrong, I appreciate their perspective. So thank you.
I agree. I immediately want to know what they mean. I mean, I've been told, mm-hmm. you're a great teacher. It's like, well, I want to be a student again.
Right.
You know, I want to be learning. So finding out you're wrong is kind of fun, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, I love to be proved wrong. Don't get me wrong. I will be a little bit upset if I'm wrong, but at the same time,
right.
You know, I'm not upset with the person that's proving me wrong. No. I'm upset with myself for having wrong information.
For the time you invested in a wrong tangent, right?
Oh, absolutely. Like, you know, especially when you're like dead certain that what you've known is correct. Yeah. And then all of a sudden you're presented with irrefutable proof. And it's like,
yeah.
How in the hell did I miss this?
Jesus holding a frog, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I like that. I got a good question for you, Marco, and I don't know. This is one of my own. Is anything provable or real to all, or can anything be subject to alternative facts?
Well, that's what we talked about recently, Zach and I. Perception.
So you got into my subconscious as I was doing the note and listening to your show.
We were preparing.
Nice.
And perception is something that we have to use and deal with. I think our mind emulates, virtually emulates reality, right? It's constantly drawing what we see, like a computer program, mm-hmm. Or a character moving through a video game. So there's people that believe that only what we witness is real, and everything outside of our ability to see and think doesn't exist until we dream it. I think that's a bit too existential. Number one, where's the evidence for that? I'm very much, you know, a hard data kind of person. But also, I think that yes, what we perceive can as real will change, and it does change, and that's where we bristle. That's where we butt heads, and it's used against us. That's my mm-hmm. my biggest fear, my biggest contention with social media is that is constantly being used. We're constantly pitted against each other over things that I thought we had settled at least 40 years ago, but here we are.
My perspective is this, and it's more important than your visualization of it, right?
Well, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, our ego was given to us as a broadsword, and how many of us turn it into a scalpel?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I always look at perspectives as sunglasses. And because when I was a kid, I had like green sunglasses and red sunglasses. And when you took them off, you could still see the world through those glasses. And so I love gathering perspectives and then looking at a situation through all of them and finding the one constant, the one spot in the Venn diagram of all of them that's real. You know, that's what I use perspectives for. I think I'm a vessel for other people's perspectives. I don't really know if I have one of my own until I'm in the silence long enough, you know?
Well, you could say, I would say it's a disputation even for satisfaction, right?
Yeah.
You know, when do you stop?
Never.
Are you satisfied?
Never.
Mm-hmm.
How about you, Jeffrey? Is there anything that's real? I mean, if I tell you that something is red, can we both be assured that we're seeing the same color red?
Ooh, another thought experiment.
Kind of. Yeah.
I love these. So we talk about what is real mm-hmm. a lot. You know, we a lot of times we try to limit it down to the five senses. Okay. So here's my question then. Have you ever had a dream that has literally incorporated all of your five senses? And then you wake up. Yeah. Was that not real? And you can make the argument that it is and it isn't. So I'll argue both. A dream isn't real because we know that when we wake up, we're back in reality. There are things we can touch, see, taste, smell. And we know that what we experienced was chemicals and neurons firing to create pictures and sensations, no different than what our brain does. But then by that same regard, what makes a dream real is the fact that it takes all of our senses and applies them in such a way that we feel, we can taste, we can smell, we can hear, we can do all of these things within our dreams. And oftentimes, you know, like real life, we have no control over those very same things. So are dreams reality? And can reality be a dream? And I think that you would be hard pressed to say one way or the other. And of course, there's going to be people that sit down and go, well, a dream can't be reality. That's not possible. But wasn't it real to your mind in those moments?
Those are the same things, reality and real. Like Marco was saying that he takes lessons away from his nightmares because they prepare him for events in real life of equal danger, right? And so he takes mm-hmm. lessons away from a dream, which is tangible and something he can access, which makes them real. But I don't know if that dream that he experienced is a reality.
But then here you go. This is where it gets absolutely difficult mm-hmm. to say that it isn't reality. You have no experience in interpreting reality beyond your own experience.
Right.
What you view as reality is going to be different from what I view as reality. Mm. Just in the way by nature that we experience life through our own senses. Your reality has been altered by the fact that your ability to see is much different than, let's say, the reality that you have in dreaming. My reality of being able to see, my reality in my dreams, Marco's reality of being able to see. So by the definition of reality, using all of these senses, does that mean that what you experience is more akin to a dream than actual reality? Because you are, how do I say it, inhibited in one particular sense, much like you might be inhibited within a dream.
Is there moments in sleep when we are able to move into another dimension that is real?
Well, when I was 15, I thought that was. I studied out-of-body experiences, and I was set on making it happen. I listened to a lot of Art Bell and Coast to Coast. I don't know if you guys remember that show in the 90s.
Yep.
And so that was all about anything that was considered controversial. You know, aliens and metaphysics, you name it.
Yeah, yeah.
I did succeed at two things. One, I learned an amazing body relaxation technique that allows me to sleep at will. And it's very simple. I can explain it if you want.
Really?
And two,
yeah.
That I discovered, what I essentially discovered was meditation. Mm. And I meditated for many years after that, but I had been doing it wrong. And I think that was a huge change in my perception when I realized that meditation was not relaxation technique, but really just being a witness to yourself, to your own thoughts and to the things around you. But the relaxation part of it that I learned from this many books I'd read at the time was to, when you're laying on your back and you're in bed, you begin with your toes. The first thing you can feel at the bottom of your body, or the end of your body, however you want to look at that, the muscles that you can feel, tense them and hold them tensed for 15 seconds. And do that all the way up your body, every time tensing for 15 seconds until you reach the last muscle that you can feel in your head or your scalp. And when you do that, your body will feel, I guarantee, like a puddle, on the floor. You will be so relaxed and your mind so clear and so open. And because I had done it the first time I did that correctly, I had this incredibly horrible feeling. It was terrifying the first time, of falling through my bed, which was, according to the books I had read, the first step into leaving your body. Nice. Which, just so we're clear, I don't believe you can do, at least from my point of view, but that experience was terrifying. It literally felt like I was leaving my body and I'd experienced paralysis. I could not move, I couldn't scream or speak, and it lasted, I want to say, about 20 seconds, which is an eternity, by the way.
Yeah.
When you lose control of your body.
Yeah, try and record forever. Something for 20 seconds. It takes forever. Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe we can leave our bodies. So that's very interesting. I like that.
Yeah, I can't say we don't. I don't believe we can. I haven't done it properly, maybe.
Right. But I love this idea of taking the beginning of the show and the end of our show and like trying that relaxation exercise in a puddle of cuddle.
There you go. It's full circle.
Full circle. Yeah, I like that idea of relaxation. I like giving people the chance to do it. I like this. This has been a pretty good show. I don't know if I want to go much further. Let's see. We did the meat thing. We answered a lot of the questions just in normal conversation. Should murderers be executed?
I've talked about my perspective before, so I'm actually interested to hear what you have to say, Marco.
So I'm immediately at least reminded of an example that Sam Harris gave at a free will lecture in Australia, where he, I'll try to shorten it, but basically imagine you're just sitting somewhere, say a bench, and you're attacked by a crocodile. And the crocodile rips off one of your hands, right? But you recover, you survive. You may at one point after you've healed, even look back on the situation somewhat jovially, because you know, if it's now in, let's say, an enclosure at a zoo or something, you can take your friends and your family to visit and say, that's the beast that almost killed me. And boy, what a great story it makes. But when you swap out the crocodile for a man with an axe, something drastically changes, not just in how you feel about the event, but also how it will sort of unfold, let's say, legally, right? Because we'll prosecute a man with an axe. We won't prosecute a crocodile, at least not anymore. And we also don't feel guilty about killing the crocodile. Not really. We're not going to stop society, you know, and change a great deal of laws or suggest a great change in laws just because we killed a crocodile that took a man's hand. But we will if we start to judge a man with an axe, because let's say the motive of the man with an axe was psychopathic. He's mentally ill. So he was literally playing out the same, his brain is playing out the same events that a crocodile will. He's not within control, let's say.
Instinctive.
Willful control. Right. It's all instinctive. So he's doing what the crocodile would have done. So is he a crocodile? And if you could cure him with, say, a pill or some type of medical technology, would you then want to still judge him? Would you want to kill him? So I think that's where I personally draw the line. I think that it is important to have harsh punishment in order to establish the veracity of laws that need to be vicious, because what is our judicial system? It's an attempt at decency. It's man's feeble, if I can steal from, you know, the Bonfire of the Vanities, it's man's feeble attempt at decency. So if we keep everything too lukewarm, then it doesn't mean anything. It won't have the impact we want it to have, which is technically the greater good, let's right. call it. But if we could cure a murderer, a psychopath at least, of, let's say, his mental illness, his impulse to kill or to harm, then I think morally we should. What we do with him after that, how he suffers or how he rehabilitates after that, that's an even bigger topic. But I think the goal is to fix the person. I also feel that people who serve, I'll end with this, people who do serve, let's say, a long time in prison, because I've known many ex-cons for different reasons, and I do consider them, for the most part, rehabilitated. They paid their debt to society, so they should be treated as citizens again. Again, there's exceptions, but that's how I feel about it.
Agreed. I believe that prison should be an education system that churns out doctorates and bachelors and masters.
Yes.
I think that would be great. And I think that if we had free healthcare and free mental health care for every individual in America, we could stop the murderers and rapists and pedophiles before they became assailants. Because I think if they had an off ramp to say, I want to kill somebody, and somebody was there to say, here's why you shouldn't, before they did it, maybe they wouldn't. And then we would know the extremists from just the spontaneous, you know what I mean?
I'm going to rock the boat a little bit.
Rock the Casbah. Here. Rock the Casbah, buddy.
I don't believe life has the same sanctity as most other people do. And well, I say that not because I don't think, you know, life is precious. I do think that life can be, but this idea that it is, you know, this thing that we have to protect in you know, I would say the traditional Christian way is an outdated way of thinking when we were a much smaller population that didn't really necessarily understand the mechanics of how life was created.
Right.
And so what we're looking at with, you know, almost 8 billion people on the planet is that, you know, we know how life works. We know how life is created. Life gets churned out every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at that life that gets churned out every single day, it is clear that if life were sacred, life would be treated the same from one end to the other. And it's not. Nobody thinks that way. They think that way from a book. They think that way from a sermon. They think that way from a religious perspective, or, you know, some type of spiritual perspective. But the way in which life is treated is very much not that way. Now, differences. I don't agree with the death penalty for the same reason most people don't agree with the death penalty. I don't agree with the death penalty, not because I think life is sacred. I don't agree with the death penalty because the cost of getting somebody to the electric chair, to lethal injection, is worth far more than if they were housed within the system for the rest of their lives. And that's either attempted,
yeah.
and either they are, you know, worked with or rehabilitated, or they're not, and they're just a person that belongs locked away from society because they are a danger. Yeah. But the other reason why I also do not like the death penalty is because there is a 4% chance, as things currently stand, that person sitting on death row is an innocent person. And I firmly do not believe in executing innocence. And so if you're telling me, if there is a 4% chance that there is somebody that is sitting there in a cell, 1 in 25, one of those people did not have anything to do with or is not guilty of a crime that deserves death, that is a huge problem to me. That is not worth executing everybody.
Gross. Well, I think that's an important distinction. I actually agree. I think in my mind, where I agree with violence as an answer, especially like permanent violence, is in the response. Like if you're being attacked,
right?
If you need to protect, yourself, or even someone important to you,
right?
And the only answer is to eliminate the attacker, then you should. But yep. I think I agree. It's rather impractical. There's a lot of things. Especially with the prison system, just from what I learned from listening to others that have been in it, that is just hugely impractical.
Agreed.
And expensive to us, but lucrative to others. And that was something I learned when I worked in construction for the state of Illinois, that it's in many ways a money machine where they're betting our tax dollars, so they have no loss on their investment.
Right.
So that it's all over, definitely.
Yeah.
Yep.
We have to end this episode, but I do want to say somebody that's guilty of one thing might be innocent of 99 other things. You know, it's like, maybe, I don't know, maybe there's something went wrong in the person, but that doesn't mean that they're all bad. I like the rehabilitation if our system was rehabilitating people. Thank you for listening to Public Access America. Come back this Thursday for more fun and action.
To those who would tear we will defeat you.
This is our moment. This is our time.
To those who seek peace and security, we support you.
Yes, we can.
And to all those who have wondered if America's beacon still burns as bright, tonight we prove once more that the true strength of our nation comes not from the might of our arms or the scale of our wealth, but from the enduring power of our ideals, democracy, liberty, opportunity, and unyielding hope.
Let me tell you something you already know. Sunshine and rainbow. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life.
Ask not.
Yes, we can.
What your country can do for you.
I have a dream.
Ask what you can do for your country.
I, poor little children,
Yes, we can.
One day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression.
In this lifetime, you don't have to prove nothing to nobody except yourself.
But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward.
That's how winning is done.
Welcome to Public Access America.
Yes, we can.
Sunday live streams Sunday on live YouTube.
I wanted to run out of that tunnel for my dad.
On Twitter. Apple Podcasts.
Stitcher, Smart Radio app,
Public. And Spotify.
Yes, we can.
Public Access America. History in the making. Making history in the making.